Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is April 2nd, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Cry Me a River, Early Goal-Directed Therapy. Our guest skeptic today is Dr. Sunil Upadhyay, and Sunil is a founding member of the Beam Dream Team. He also presented at Sweet Beam with Anthony and I recently in Stockholm, Sweden. Welcome back to the SGEM, Sunil.
Thanks, Ken. Good to be back.
So tell the audience there where you work and what official hats do you wear?
So the official hats I have is I work at McMaster University as a full-time emergency physician at St. Joseph's Hospital. I'm an associate clinical professor at the Department of Emergency Medicine at McMaster. And I'm also the chair of the Standards Committee for the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians. Those are my official hats. My unofficial hats is sometimes instead of a medical hat, I'll wear a scuba mask when I'm diving in various lovely places around the world, and also a jazz hat when I'm playing jazz music with Anthony and various other musicians, which is my great passion.
Well, I understand also that sepsis is one of your favorite topics, correct?
It is. It's been one of my clinical areas of interest for both work and research for the last 6 or 7 years, and we've been working on a sepsis protocol that we can talk about later.
Great. Well, obviously, I've got the right person on the program today, but we like to start these podcasts with a case scenario. So have you brought us a case so that we can put it in context?
I do, and I think this will actually be a relevant case for those emergency physicians who work in smaller centers and rural communities like yourself, Ken.
So what do you got for a case?
So here's the case scenario. You are working in a rural community emergency department. The next patient you see is a 71-year-old man from a nursing home who has been sick for 3 days with a fever, chills, and now a productive cough. On arrival, his vital signs are as follows. His temperature is 38.7 degrees Celsius. His heart rate is 110 beats per minute. His respiratory rate is 24. His blood pressure is 95 over 60, and this is after a 500cc normal saline bolus given by the ambulance personnel en route to the hospital. And finally, his oxygen saturations are 88% on room air. When you look at him, his skin looks mottled, and the patient seems to be confused on questioning, even though you've never met him before. So you diagnose tentatively this patient to be in septic shock and administer another intravenous crystalloid fluid bolus. You start broad-spectrum antibiotics, and you place this patient on an oxygen mask. Your hospital does not have critical care facilities, and if this patient's going to require intubation or invasive vascular monitoring, for example, a central venous pressure line or an arterial line for measuring mean arterial pressure, this patient will have to be transferred out to a larger center, which has resource implications for where you work. You are aware that the early goal-directed therapy protocols mandated in the 2013 Surviving Sepsis Campaign Guidelines update include such invasive measures as I just discussed. You're also aware that there have been numerous concerns over the past decade that such aggressive invasive measures may not be necessary for resuscitating septic patients, and more conservative measures limited to just intravenous crystalloid boluses, broad-spectrum antibiotics, and serial lactate monitoring may in fact be just as effective.
Sunil, I really appreciate the fact that you presented a rural case or a regional case, because a lot of this stuff always takes place in these ivory towers or these tertiary care centers. And a lot of us, like you said, don't practice in those environments. So it's really, really nice of you to set up the case that it doesn't take place in one of these ivory towers.
Because I think this is important, Ken. Sorry to interrupt. Because I've been to many conferences in Canada and the United States over the last decade since the introduction of early goal-directed therapy, at which, you know, leaders like Manny Rivers and Alan Jones and what have you are presenting on panels for sepsis care. And often many questions in the audience at the end of these panels are from rural physicians saying, how can we do this aggressive care in a small, under-resourced environment in rural communities?
So that's perfect, because that's the question really we have based on the case and about the paper we're going to be talking about. And the question is early goal-directed therapy or some other protocol-based care superior to just usual care for septic shock patients in the emergency department. And as some background, you know that this all started 10 years ago when Dr. Emmanuel Rivers, Manny maybe to his friends, published his single-center randomized control trial showing early goal-directed therapy could reduce septic mortality a stellar amount. It went for something like 46 or 47% down to about 30, 31%. And that gives you an NNT of 6. I mean, for mortality, an NNT of 6, that was phenomenal. And I think that just changed the world over the 2000s, didn't it, Sunil?
I absolutely agree. This was a game breaker in emergency medicine and changed the landscape of sepsis care in the ED, the emergency department, forever.
So he suggested this bundle. So his bundle put emphasis on early recognition of sepsis, IV fluids, and broad-spectrum antibiotics. It also included vasopressors, ionotropes, and blood transfusions. And monitoring required placement of a central venous catheter. So, Sunil, you're the expert. I want to ask you a little bit about some of those key elements. So what do you think about this early recognition idea?
Well, early recognition of the septic patient is where everything starts in the emergency department, as you know, Ken. If you can't find them, you can't treat them, and if you can't treat them early enough, you won't save them. So early recognition is predicated on the systemic inflammatory response syndrome, or SIRS, criteria, which are outlined in the show notes. It was also noted that with early recognition, there should be rapid use of appropriate broad-spectrum antibiotics. It was shown in a ICU-based database review a number of years back that in a septic patient who goes hypotensive, every hour of delay of appropriate antibiotics increases that mortality by 7.6% per hour. So you can imagine in a 12-hour shift overnight, if a patient goes hypotensive and is not recognized, 12 hours later, there's a 96% chance that patient's going to be dead.
Wow. So if you don't look for it, obviously, you're not going to find it. And if you delay looking for it, for every 60 minutes that goes by, it's about 7.5% increase in mortality. That is huge. Time is important.
This is a time-dependent emergency, right on par with ST elevation MI, acute trauma, and acute stroke, which has been talked about in previous episodes of the SGEM.
Oh, don't get me started on, you know, time-dependent stuff for stroke here. That'll be another podcast. So how about IV fluids? I mean, you know, the standard recommendation is 30 cc's per kilogram for a bolus. What, you know, what's important here? Is it crystalloids or colloids?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the practice of emergency medicine is really the cornerstone is resuscitation. We do resuscitation more and ideally better than everybody else.
We own it.
We own it. And hemodynamic resuscitation is based on vascular refilling. In septic patients, there's an abundance of recent evidence, both in randomized clinical trials and a Cochrane systematic review last year, that intravenous crystalloids are superior to colloids when it comes to fluid resuscitation of critically ill patients.
So crystalloids before colloids, correct?
That is correct.
And does it matter which type of crystalloid you use?
It does not. There's been no evidence to show that normal saline is any different than Ringer's lactate, and there's been no evidence to show that Ringer's lactate will abnormally skew lactate measurements in septic patients, so either crystalloid is absolutely fine.
You know, I didn't even think about that, about the Ringer's lactate and the lactate level until you mentioned that just now. That's great. That's a nice little pearl here.
It's a question that's come up in a variety of lectures I've done over the last decade, and there's no evidence that that is an error in the reading if you use Ringer's lactate.
And then the other thing was broad-spectrum antibiotics. Why are we shooting at such a big target?
The benefit that other physicians have in hospital-based sepsis care that we do not have in the emergency department as patients rule through the door is they know where the infection's coming from, and they can make a very good guess then as to what bugs or pathogens are causing the sepsis. We don't really always have that luxury in the emergency department, so we have to shoot broad, and then when the blood cultures come back, doctor somebody else a day or two later, once the patient's been admitted, can tailor and specify the antibiotics to the appropriate bug.
So we can shoot first? We can shoot first and ask questions like, what was it later?
Correct.
And nobody's suggesting that we wait for a culture insensitivity before we start antibiotics.
Absolutely not, since it's not realistic in the time frame that we're dealing with sepsis and septic shock, which, as we've said before, is a time-dependent emergency.
All right, so let's talk about this new trial that just came out in the New England Journal of Medicine. I think it's called the PROCESS trial. Could you introduce it?
Absolutely. This is an investigation that's been going on for 7 years, based out of the University of Pittsburgh by the PROCESS investigators, and this was published electronically in the New England Journal of Medicine 2 weeks ago. And the link will be in the show notes.
So hot off the press. Actually, it's not even on the press. It's in press. It's only available in electronic form, so you have to use social media to get access to this.
Correct. This has probably been one of the most torrid topics in social media for emergency medicine articles that I've ever seen.
So let's go through our PICO then. Let's talk about the population. Who were they investigating for the last 6 or 7 years?
So this trial included adult patients over 18 years old that had at least 2 of the systemic inflammatory response, or SIRS, criteria, and they had refractory hypotension after a fluid bolus that had been given, and they still had a systolic blood pressure of less than 90 millimeters of mercury, or they were requiring vasopressors, or they had a lactate greater than 4 millimolar after the fluid challenge.
So, and I think it's important, you couldn't even get into this study unless you ordered a lactate. So I think that's really emphasizes that we need to be ordering these lactates to try to identify some of these patients.
Agreed. Nathan Shapiro proved the utility of lactate since 2005, and this has been repeatedly validated as an important marker of sepsis prognosis in the critical care literature since then.
And there was a whole bunch of exclusion criteria, but I'm not going to go through them. I'll throw them up on the blog, and people can read through all those exclusion criteria. What was the intervention that they were comparing?
So what they wanted to compare was the classic 2001 Rivers early goal-directed therapy aggressive invasive protocol with other protocolized care that was based on literature reviews across the world, expert opinions from emergency physicians and ICU specialists across the world. And the third arm was the so-called usual care, so anything a normal ER physician would do at their discretion.
And I'm just going to put a little emphasis, their, quote, usual care was pretty darn good care, though.
It was, and this is a typical finding in randomized trials at the same sites where the physicians know what they should be doing, so they tend to raise the bar in the study environment, and this is almost a Hawthorne-type effect, whereas for the real world, the usual care would probably be even less than what these physicians did during this trial.
So just a little caution as we're going through this PICO that their usual care in this study environment may not be the typical usual care.
Agreed. It probably exceeds what most emergency physicians in non-study settings would actually do with their patients.
So what was the outcome? What was the primary outcome that they were looking for?
So the primary outcome that these authors powered this study to was in-hospital death by any cause at 60 days.
So just 2 months out, they were just going to check how many were alive and how many were dead and in hospital.
Absolutely.
And then their secondary outcomes?
The secondary outcomes include any death by 90 days, cumulative death rates at 90 days and 1 year, duration of any events of cardiovascular failure, respiratory failure, and acute renal failure. They also looked at hospital and intensive care unit length of stay. And finally, they looked at hospital discharge and disposition. For example, did the patients go home? Did they go to a nursing home? Did they go to another long-term care facility? And so on.
So before we critically evaluate the paper, what were the author's conclusions?
Well, the author's punchline at the end was, quote, in a multi-center trial conducted in the tertiary care setting, protocol-based resuscitation of patients in whom septic shock was diagnosed in emergency departments did not improve outcomes, unquote.
All right, so let's go through the BEAM critical quality checklist. And for a randomized trial, there's 11 questions we ask, and I'll just run through them with you quickly. Sunil, were these emergency department patients?
Absolutely, and this is one of the rare huge randomized trials where this is focused exclusively in the emergency department. So we have to pay attention to these types of trials.
Sepsis, we own it. How about randomization?
So these patients were appropriately randomized through computerized generated tables in a 1-to-1-to-1 block randomization program.
So was the randomization concealed?
It was.
And were the individuals analyzed in the groups which way they were randomized to?
The author's intention was to do an intention-to-treat analysis, so yes.
Are these consecutively recruited patients?
This one was hard to tell because it wasn't clearly stated in either the main paper or in the supplementary index, which is available for download online.
All right. So how about the patient groups? Were they similar at the start of the study? Because we want to know that these are equally balanced and we've got the same sort of burden of illness with the different groups.
So if you look at table one, which is in the main paper on page 6, you will see that they're nearly identical in all three groups.
Now, were people unaware of their group allocation?
They were initially.
Okay, and were they treated equally through the study?
Yes. Again, if you look at the interventions done in the tables, you can see they were treated nearly identically.
So treated equally as in except for the thing that they were looking at?
Correct.
And how about follow-up? Did they have good follow-up, i.e. greater than 80%?
There was near perfect follow-up in all three groups. If you look at figure one, which is the consort diagram, they lost only about 3 or 4 patients in each arm out of over 400, which is spectacular follow-up.
That is spectacular, isn't it? How about patient-oriented outcomes? Were they concerned with those?
Well, patients, I'm sure, are worried if they die, their hearts fail, their lungs fail, their kidneys fail, and if they get to go home. So these are patient-oriented outcomes, absolutely.
Yeah, I thought they were really good outcomes, alive or dead. Yep, good. How about the treatment effect? Was the treatment effect large and precise?
I would have to say they were precise. In the true sense of what this treatment effect large, you'd have to say no, because there was no difference between the various groups, and we'll get into that. But compared to no treatment at all, which was the so-called standard of care in the Rivers trial originally, you've already mentioned that the treatment effect of any protocolized care is huge, with an NNT, number needed to treat, of 6 to save one life.
Yeah, they had a mortality rate of 46% in the, you know, usual care, not the usual care in this study, but in Manny Rivers' trial, it was 46%. So they didn't do that here.
No, they didn't.
So let's go through the key results. First of all, this was a multi-center trial. It had 31 different centers, and they screened about 12,000 patients, and they ultimately included 10% or 1,300 patients in the trial. And Sunil, I was going to ask you just a little bit about how they trained to do the different protocols and also about the protocol-based approach using their clinical judgment.
Yes, Ken. The details of this are listed in the online supplemental index. So all of the emergency department physicians and resuscitation teams were trained in the different protocols. They used a train-the-trainer approach, so key personnel at each site were trained, and then they went back to their own centers and trained the rest of the teams. There was ongoing telephone support at the main coordinating study center, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the main study center also sent out routine team leaders for site visits and to provide audit and feedback and other support processes.
So how about the protocol-based fluid loading based on the clinical findings?
This was actually excellent. So in the first arm, which is early goal-directed therapy, there was no clinical judgment involved. Just like the original Rivers paper in 2001, everybody just responded to the numbers. CVP of 8 to 12, mean arterial pressure of 65, SVO2 of greater than 70%. Now, in the second arm of this study, the so-called protocol-based fluid loading was based on clinical findings. So was there evidence of jugular venous distension? If you listened to the chest, did you hear crackles and rails? Was there a decrease in pulse oximetry readings because the chest was getting overloaded? And were there signs of clinical hypoperfusion? So mottled skin, decreased urinary output or oliguria, altered mental status, and if you had a mean arterial pressure, was it less than 65 with a systolic blood pressure of greater than 100? And if you were monitoring arterial lactate levels, was that number still greater than 4? It's important to realize that this is probably what most clinicians do. They look at their clinical judgment and clinical findings to find out if they decide that the patient is, in fact, appropriately fluid resuscitated or not. And very rarely do the bigger centers use invasive monitors like CVP and mean arterial pressure or wedge index or whatever you want to use to determine if the patient is adequately fluid resuscitated. And this is my center included as well.
All right, that's great, Sunil. Let's go through the outcomes here. So okay. Their primary outcome, what was their primary outcome? What was their 60-day mortality rate?
There was absolutely no difference between the three groups of that were being compared. In early goal-directed therapy, the 60-day mortality was 21%. In protocol-driven therapy, it was 18.2%. And in the usual care arm, it was 18.9%.
Wow. So their primary outcome was no difference for mortality at 60 days, roughly 20% across the board.
Correct.
Well, how about their secondary outcome, death at 90 days?
Again, there was no difference. These numbers were 32%, 31%, and 34%, respectively.
How about ICU admissions? Was there at least a difference in that?
There was a difference because in early goal-directed therapy, it's mandated that these patients be admitted to the ICU. But even then, these numbers weren't that huge. 91% of the early goal-directed therapy patients were admitted to the intensive care unit, compared to 85% of the protocol-based patients and 86% of the usual care patients.
How about things like hospital length of stay? Was there a difference there?
No difference at all. 11 to 12 days across the board for all three groups.
How about organ system failure?
No significant differences for cardiovascular, respiratory failures. There was a slight increase in acute renal failure that required dialysis in the protocol group, but that was it.
And how about adverse events?
There was no difference in adverse events between early goal-directed therapy, protocol care, or usual care.
How about disposition destinations?
Again, no differences in the three arms. A bunch of people went home, a bunch of people went to a nursing home or other long-term care facilities, but there seemed to be no difference in those disposition destinations within the three arms.
I'm sensing a trend in these outcomes. Are you?
Certainly not of one big difference, that's for sure.
No difference, no difference, no difference. Well, let's talk about protocol performance, though. How well did people perform in these protocols, specifically with the early goal-directed therapy and the other standard protocol and the usual care? How well did they adhere to all of these things?
So adherence to the protocols was reported in the supplemental index from 0 to 6 hours. 89% of the patients were successfully treated by protocol in early goal-directed therapy, and in the standardized protocol, it was 96%. Of course, in the usual care, there's no protocol, so this is not applicable there.
So I guess it would be 100% for the usual care arm.
Pretty much.
How about IV fluid use?
So about 96% of the time, overall crystalloids were used. Now, colloids were not excluded from use, nor were they encouraged, so it was neutral in terms of whether or not to use colloids or not. There was more fluids given in the protocol arm, an average of 3.3 liters, interestingly, compared to early goal-directed therapy, which is 2.8 liters, or the usual care arm, which was 2.3 liters on average.
And yeah, there's been some buzz about, you know, how much fluids everybody got in this, but they all got 2 liters up front. So the real numbers are something like 5.3 liters, 4.8 liters, and 4.3 liters again, because they all got 2 liters up front, right?
They got lots of fluids, and this is consistent with what the Rivers protocol was, which with that average was 5 liters in the intervention arm compared to 1 to 2 liters in the control arm in 2001.
And this is a bit of an interesting tidbit. How about IV antibiotics? Did they all get them?
They all did, and it was spectacular performance. In the appropriate antibiotic usage was in 97% in all three arms within 6 hours.
How about CVP, or central venous pressure line placement?
So this is where there was a big difference amongst the three groups, according to the original Rivers protocol. So the early goal-directed therapy group had 94% use of CVP line placement immediately, whereas in the protocolized standard care, they had 56% use, and in the usual care, they had about 58% use. Interestingly, SpO2 central oxygenation monitoring, which is mandated in early goal-directed therapy, was used over 90% of the time in early goal-directed therapy arm. But in the protocol arm and the usual care arm, there was a huge difference. Only 4% use for central monitoring in protocol care and 3.5% usual care. So even those patients who got CVP lines, it was only for fluid resuscitation, not for central venous oxygenation like the original early goal-directed therapy arm patients did.
So let's take a pause there. I think that's really important. So twice as many people, roughly, got CVP line placement in the early goal-directed therapy arm. And that makes sense because that's part of the early goal-directed therapy, right? So 94% got this central line placement. But a lot of people still got central line placements in the two other groups, but about half the amount of the early goal-directed therapy. But then when they did it, they didn't really do anything with the monitoring, did they?
All they used it, the central line for, was flooding in fluids faster in the protocol arm and usual arm care. They did not use it for oxygenation measurement at all.
And that's one of the main things that people talk about using the CVP for, isn't it?
That is correct.
Interesting. How about vasopressor use?
Vasopressor use was pretty consistent across the board, 55% in early goal-directed therapy, 52% in the protocolized base care, and about 44% in the usual care arm.
And did they use much dobutamine?
This was very rarely used, 8%, 1.1%, and 0.9% across the three arms.
And how about their blood transfusion rate?
So the blood transfusion threshold in this trial was set at less than 7.5 grams per deciliter, which translates to 4.5 millimolar. And the rates were 14.4% in early goal-directed therapy, 8% in protocolized care, and 7.5%. So no significant difference, really, amongst the three arms.
All right, so let's get into a bit of the commentary. Overall, what did you think of this study and their methods?
This was a very well-executed three-arm parallel RCT that looked at three likely resuscitation scenarios: invasive aggressive early goal-directed therapy-based interventions, watered-down, less invasive, protocolized care nonetheless, and then just the so-called usual care by physicians.
And they did something called block randomization, where they had one-to-one-to-one block randomization. I wonder if you can take a moment and talk nerdy to me. Not dirty, nerdy, okay, Sunil? Talk nerdy to me. What's block randomization?
So the principle behind block randomization is if you have two groups or three groups and you're randomizing a lot of people into either of those arms, on a very rare chance alone, you could be recruiting, for example, 100 patients, and 99 of them could end up in treatment arm one, and one person ends up in treatment arm two. So by accidents of chance alone, your randomization failed to equalize both groups. This can be overcome by block randomization, where you specify blocks of, in this case, three patients, six patients, nine patient blocks at a time. And within that block, there's a guarantee that somewhere along the line, patients will be randomized equally to treatment arm A, B, or C. And in a six patient block, for example, that algorithm can be AA, BB, CC, and then the next block can be ACB, BCA, CBC, ABCA, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, you're getting a bit too nerdy for me, but I think I get it.
Very good.
All right, well, we mentioned blinding before in the quality checklist, but can you comment further on the blinding?
Sure. As you can imagine in this study, it's going to be really difficult to blind the physicians because they know immediately as soon as they start that whether they're doing early goal-directed therapy invasively, protocolized-based, minimally invasive treatment, or usual care. So blinding physicians is not practical. The patients may or may not be blindable, but they may not really get what's happening anyway, so that may not be an appropriate population to worry about. However, when you look at the original methods in the paper, they did lock the outcomes data until the trial was over and reopened in December of 2013. So the clinical investigators were unaware of the different arm outcomes until the study was long over from a recruiting point of view.
One of the things I noticed, Sunil, when I was reading through the paper is they changed their sample size partway through the study. Did this raise any concerns from your perspective?
Not really. I would say that the explanation was quite appropriate. At the start of the trial, based on mortalities that was reported in the Rivers trial, they initially estimated a sample size of 1,950 patients that had to be separated amongst the three arms for appropriate power calculations. They did plan with a data safety monitoring committee to have two interim analyses. At the first interim analysis, they realized that the observed mortality rate in the control arm was far less than what was observed in the RIVER study 11 years ago. And with a recalculation, they were able to reduce the required sample size from 1,950 to 1,350 while still preserving the appropriate power metrics that they wanted in the original calculation.
So what does this study then, this process trial, what does this study say about Dr. Rivers' early goal-directed therapy paper?
The authors are very clear about not wanting to rebuke or refute the Rivers findings because they were seminal and revolutionary 10 years ago. What this does is refine the revolutionary care pioneered by Rivers back in 2001. It does refute the need for universal invasive monitoring, which I'm sure most emergency department physicians in smaller and rural settings will find most welcome because they just can't do it without the technical support or expertise to fully execute the original protocol.
And so what does this process trial say about antibiotics, fluids, and lactates?
I think this trial reaffirms also the importance of early recognition, serial lactate monitoring, aggressive intravenous crystalloid resuscitation, and the importance of early antibiotics. The options here can certainly be extrapolated to those patients probably who are in severe sepsis as well as septic shock, even though that population wasn't studied in this trial.
Is bundled care then dead, or what should we do?
I would say absolutely not. I think this article does not refute the value of bundled care because there's too many trials and meta-analyses in the last few years that suggest a protocol for such sick patients will be of significant benefit to reduce patient morbidity and mortality. However, this study does suggest that it doesn't have to be all or nothing super invasive strategies similar to the early goal-directed therapy. You can probably get away with a less invasive strategy or a more conservative strategy and still achieve the same outcomes as long as you hit the big targets of fluids, antibiotics, and early recognition.
Okay, well, how about the vasopressor debate? You know, this norepinephrine versus dopamine.
There's no debate on this anymore, Ken. There's enough recent literature, both again in randomized trials and Cochrane reviews and other systematic reviews, that suggest that norepinephrine is in fact the vasopressor of choice in sepsis patients, septic shock patients, what have you. There are clear recommendations on this in the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines published last year, and another meta-analysis in critical care medicine by DeBacker et al. In 2012 that reaffirmed this. Norepinephrine, yes. Dopamine, no.
So this study, this process trial, must have grabbed the attention of the Surviving Sepsis Campaign people. Have they jumped in and commented on this at all?
They had no choice to jump in and comment on this because this has been one of the biggest developments in sepsis care since 2001. And given that they just published their updated guidelines in 2013, they couldn't afford to be silent on this.
So what did they say?
So they've outlined five things, which for you, Ken, I know is your favorite number.
Well, I can count to it on one hand, Sunil. I'm a simple guy.
Perfect. As can we all. So the five things they emphasized was the importance of early recognition based on SIRS criteria, like we've discussed. The second thing they noted was that the 18% mortality rate in the usual care arm is far superior to the original 46% control arm mortality seen in the Rivers 2001 trial. This is likely because sepsis care has received so much attention in the last decade, and everybody's doing a better job at this. Thirdly, because the mortality rate in the control arm and two other large trials, which are the Australian ARISE trial and the United Kingdom PROMISE trial, which hopefully will be done in the next year and published there, the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guideline did not feel any need to revise their bundles 1 year after their update. They also noted that the PROCESS trial did not answer the question about using a protocol to manage patients with severe sepsis without septic shock. But I think we can all read into this study that at least for protocolized care and usual care, you can extrapolate this data to that population of severe sepsis without septic shock. Finally, in the Surviving Sepsis Campaign 6-hour bundle, they still support a target of mean arterial pressure of 65 millimeters of mercury. They do not necessarily address lactate testing in the PROCESS trial, but we know from Bryant Nguyen's study in Critical Care Medicine 2004 that the target of lactate reduction should be at least 10% if you're successfully resuscitating these patients over the first 6 hours. And in PROCESS, more than half of the usual care and protocol-based patients still got central lines, although again, these were only used for fluid management, not for central oxygenation monitoring.
So overall, what do you think of this Surviving Sepsis Campaign response to the PROCESS trial?
Rightfully so. I think they're a little bit more reserved in embracing the PROCESS results. They certainly do acknowledge and support the overall principles, since they are in fact congruent with the recent SSC updates. They do refer to a companion paper with regards to targeting blood pressure, which should still be at 65 millimeters of mercury, and this was in the same issue of New England Journal 2014 electronically, and you're going to have a posting of this on your website.
So, Sunil, we've been talking for over a half an hour, and I'll tell you, my podcasts usually run 20 to 30 minutes, but you know what? I'm willing to extend this podcast just because this is such a big thing. This was such a big deal. I mean, I have not seen so much activity about a trial. I can't think of anything in the last 10 years. Can you?
I could probably count on one hand how many game-breaking trials in emergency medicine that we've covered in BEAM since 2005. That would include, of course, the Rivers Protocol from 2001, the CRASH-2 trial on trauma resuscitation, and maybe the COMMIT trial on clopidogrel and metoprolol in myocardial infarction. But there are not very many other game-breakers of that caliber, and this trial deserves to be in that elite company.
So then what's the bottom line?
The bottom line here on this trial is that effective care for septic shock hinges completely on early recognition, lactate screening, intravenous crystalloid resuscitation, and early broad-spectrum antibiotics. These are things that everybody probably knew and is now confirmed.
So how are you going to apply this clinically then?
This is the information that most emergency physicians have wanted since the early girl-directed therapy paper in 2001 and confirms what everybody's already suspected. And I dare say this is clinical trial information that is practice-changing and ready for prime time now.
So then what are you going to tell your septic patients when they come into the emergency department based on this PROCESS trial?
I'm going to tell them, it looks like you have a serious infection. We're going to give you intravenous fluids, broad-spectrum antibiotics, and admit you to the hospital.
And with that case, that rural or regional community case that you brought in, that 71-year-old man that looked like he probably had a respiratory infection, what's the case resolution?
So this 71-year-old fellow with a respiratory infection has gotten appropriate fluid loading and appropriate broad-spectrum IV antibiotics. He looks a little better after a couple of hours. His blood pressure is responding. And at the 6-hour mark, his lactate is responding positively. You can then discuss the case with the patient and the family. You can ask them if they would like to be transferred to a higher level of care with central monitoring, which is not necessary according to this PROCESS trial, or in fact stay locally. They decide to stay in your rural facility and consider transfer. The clinical situation takes a turn for the worst, and this is appropriate.
That's great to hear. That's really reassuring coming from a rural center like mine. Well, I guess that leaves us the Keener contest. And last week's winner was Yaroslav from Krakow. I hope I just said that reasonably close to what it really should be. Anyways, they knew the more than actually 5 reasons why a child would have sinus tachycardia. They listed pain, fever, anxiety, dehydration, malignant hyperthermia, hypovolemia with hypotension and shock, or anemia. So congratulations. I will be sending you a cool skeptical prize all the way to Poland. How about this week's Keener contest? You've got something really tough for the audience?
So this week's Keener contest question as follows. In the emergency department, what are the key 3 interventions for managing septic patients as they roll through your door?
Well, if you guys out there know the answer to this week's Keener question, which three things are key to the management of sepsis in the emergency department, just send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, and use Keener in the subject line, and the first person to correctly answer Sunil's question will receive a cool skeptical prize from me. Sunil, I just want to give a shout out to Lauren Westifer and Jeremy Faust, who suggested the theme music for today's podcast, Cry Me a River by Joe Cocker. And I'd also like to give a shout out to you for taking 40 minutes here of your time to talk about this really, really important paper. I appreciate you doing it.
It's my pleasure. This is a really important topic for emergency physicians, and it's a personal passion of mine in my clinical workplace, so I'm glad to discuss it.
Well, I know a number of other really, really smart people and opinionated people have put up some podcasts and blogs, and I'll put some links in the show notes so you can listen to those opinions as well, because it's nice to gather as many as you can and take a look at this study from lots of different angles and hear lots of different opinion. This is just the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine joining that chorus. So, Sunil, as the guest, would you be kind enough to give the tagline?
My pleasure, Ken. Thanks for having me. And remember, everybody, to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it here on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
I'll talk to everyone next week.